Time is 1:33. I call this meeting the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building here in the beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Friday, March 24th, 2023. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Juliana Singh, as well as our LIO moderator, Jake Wade. Today we have three bills on our agenda. First up, Senate Bill 89, age for tobacco / nicotine / e-cigs, tax e-cigs. Next, Senate Bill 51, controlled substance data, exempt veterinarians. Then, Senate Bill 93, Fisherman's Fund, Vessel Owner Claims. First up, Senate Bill 89, age for tobacco, nicotine, and e-cig products, tax on e-cigs. Here to present the bill, we have bill sponsor, Senate President Gary Stevens. Senator, would you please join us at the table with your staff? State your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you hearing this bill today. Senator Gary Stevens, District C. When I walked in the room, I heard people say, deja vu, we've heard this before, but it's a good bill, and I'm really pleased that you're hearing it now. What this bill is about is protecting our children, protecting them from becoming addicted to nicotine. It's about restricting sales. It's about possession of nicotine, these products by youngsters. As I'm sure you're all aware, the industry, the tobacco and nicotine industry, have been in a decline in cigarette smoking. And what they've done is respond by going into new fashionable smoking options in the form of e-cigarettes and related devices. And they are designed to appeal to a wide range of consumers, but particularly to young people. And it's working, Mr. Chairman. I certainly acknowledge that these products have helped some adults to quit smoking, but they do, however, not end addiction to nicotine. They don't do that. Instead, they provide an attractive new delivery method of maintaining the same habit. This bill is about an effort to push back on a multi-billion dollar industry that's trying to addict young people and do it as early as possible. The bill raises the legal age to sell, buy, use, and possess cigarettes and nicotine products and e-cigarette products to age 21. There's also a modest tax on e-cigarette products. Taxing these products is what has clearly shown over time to reduce consumption, particularly when it comes to young children. The data has shown that if we can interrupt the initiation of these products at younger ages, the risk of addiction is substantially reduced later in life. Now, this bill, Mr. Chairman, is consistent with law, restricting access to alcohol and marijuana, consistent with military policy, standing orders for our troops, consistent with federal law, consistent with local laws, consistent with policies on our school campuses, and presumably consistent with parents around Alaska. To not act is to turn our backs on every other governing body, including our military leaders, our teachers, and our parents. We have deferred this issue for too long, Mr. Chairman. The time is now to face this new industry to help protect young Alaskans who are being targeted for potentially a lifetime of addiction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Staff to Senator Stevens, Tim Lampkin, is also with you here today, Mr. President. Mr. Lampkin, you have a presentation for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. For many, if not all of you, this subject is not a new one for you. I believe that at least three of you here saw and helped pass this bill last year. I believe you, Senator Bjorkman, is acquainted with this subject in your school in the Kenai area. And if I'm not mistaken, Senator Dunbar may have addressed this issue at the Anchorage Assembly in the mid-2015-2018 timeframe. Before you is a bill that aligns Alaska state law with federal law. just give you a little bit of background, just in case, or a reminder, some history. E-cigarettes emerged in the United States in roughly 2005, 2007. Originally, these products were patented during World War II, but they were kind of shelved by the industry as not being popular or cool enough at that time. But since the decline of consumption of tobacco cigarettes, traditional cigarettes in the late 90s and early 2000s, this product has exploded since that time. E-cigarettes create an aerosol vapor, typically using a battery or to heat up a liquid of some kind that typically also contains nicotine, flavorings, and a broad swath of other chemicals and additives. The users then inhale this aerosol into their lungs. Now, most e-cigarettes consist of four basic parts: a cartridge or a reservoir, similar to this ink pen, that would have the juice, as they call it, inside. Say a heating element or a battery that would heat that liquid, and then a mouthpiece that would you put in your mouth and actually inhale the product. Now, some of these products, as we're going to discuss at some point, are it's very elusive product here because it's constantly emerging and changing in design. But as you will find as we dig into this bill, there's most typically the large component of this market consists of what are called closed units, closed system E6. And those are ones that are intended to be sold as a closed unit. They're not designed to be opened. They're intended to be used and then thrown away. They consist of all of those components. They're meant to be used that one time through a number of puffs or hits. And I'll come back to that. We'll go into that in a little deeper detail here shortly. But once they're consumed and they're extinguished, there's no more puffs or juice left in that device. It's intended to be thrown away. There's a substantial market. Arguably, the biggest part of the market are these disposable units. They're bought cheap. They're readily available at just about every convenience store, every gas stop in this state, or substantially so. I'll come back to that too. The other units are those that are open, and those are the ones that you can take apart and adjust their components, swap out the battery, swap out the heating coil, swap out the juice. Once that component, the juice component, is extinguished, you can pull that part out and just replace the juice that's inside. So that's kind of a simple description of what these components consist of. I would share with you that, you know, again, subsequent to the decline of traditional cigarette use, using old tobacco marketing techniques by e-cigarette tobacco manufacturers have secured their position in the foreseeable future in this market. All they needed to do was pull out from their old playbook in the 1950s. It worked, and it's worked just as well, if not more so, in modern day. To date, e-cig marketing has gone unregulated. I don't know if you listen to the radio much, but I do occasionally in my wood shop when I'm tinkering, and I regularly hear ads promoting vape use. Come on by, we're having a sale. You don't see that in tobacco these days. You don't see ads in newspapers or in magazines for tobacco products. You do, however, for vaping. They're showing their popularity among celebrities, that it's cool, it's got sex appeal, it's what the cool people do, and it's affecting our children, particularly on social media. They have quite a diverse, wide and deep network of brand promotions, paid for campaigns, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Our kids are all over this, and it's working. Perhaps even inversely or worse is the idea that this messaging has resulted in a substantial population of our parents and kids who believe that these products are no big deal. They're safe. It's fine. No problem here. It tastes good too. However, the cliche, the gimmicks here, but I brought some props for you. This is just a small sampling to see something live in person of these products confiscated in our schools. Here's some pictures of them. They very often even resemble a thumb drive, just like this. They're not much bigger than this, so they can be obscured and hidden very easily in your pocket. They don't always resemble a thumb drive, though. There's a watch there, as you see. I've seen some that resemble a Coca-Cola can. with a straw man or a lightsaber of Star Wars. Now, those are probably obsolete these days, but they were on the market at one time. So this is just a small sampling of what was found in our schools. And I guess I'll pause there. I'll share with you the fact that over the past week, in response to, because over time we've had a difficulty in getting enough awareness of this situation, and I took it upon myself to start my own campaign in our schools. I spent this past week building a database of over 400 teachers, principals, assistant principals, athletic directors, nurses, to reach out to all of them directly and say, is this a problem? I asked a question of them, a few questions. Are you witnessing e-cigarette use by young people in your schools or your community? Do you believe e-cigarette use by young people is on the rise? Do you believe e-cigarettes are safe or harmless? Which is another component of the messaging here. Has your school or community taken action to counter e-cigarette use in your school or your community, using by possession in particular by young people? As with alcohol, do you support raising the legal age to buy, sell, or possess e-cigarettes to age 21? And then finally, do you support establishing a 25% sales tax on these products? And Mr. Chairman, to date, this is a live active project that's underway, but I have received overwhelming responses from those people throughout our state. And I could rattle off all the communities that were touched. They include Fairbanks, they include Anchorage, they include Kenai, they include many rural villages, Barrow. Across the state, this is clearly and overwhelmingly a problem in our school system. I also, on that note, I should point out I have some letters of support that, just for the record, briefly, from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Alaska Mental Health Board, as well as from the Matsu Health Foundation. I'll get those to you after this hearing. So here are some other samples of what I found online. These are just like these products here. These are disposable units, the closed units. They very often have a shape or design about like this. And some pricing here as we get into this tax, and it's too high, you know, they're too expensive. I also share with you, and Senator Bishop asked for this last year, just to try to provide some parity, some analysis comparison. What are we talking about here in terms of how does this relate to a pack of cigarettes? And again, I took some time to try to draw some parallels between these products. And this morning on my way to the Capitol, I stopped by the local grocery store and a local convenience store just to see what the price schedules are for cigarettes, for example. And just as one example, I took a picture of the entire shelf of all of their cigarette products. And just for conversation, I'll say that the average price for a pack of smokes was $16. That's with the local taxes and so forth. And so if you consider the fact that a pack of cigarettes, I think we can agree, there's 20 cigarettes in a pack of smokes, right? And I looked at the analysis. There was scientific studies out there. How many drags, how many hits, how many puffs are there in a typical cigarette? And that was somewhere between 7-8, call it 7.5 puffs per cigarette. So if you look at these products, and I'll back up a minute, these products here, and I'll point out to you, they're pre-filled with a certain amount of liquid. They have a number of hits, anywhere from 1,900 up to 5,000 hits per these pods, right? So if you back up to a cigarette, and per pack of 20 cigarettes, that works out to about 150 hits in a pack of smokes. And so if we put aside the idea of how much nicotine's in it, and all that, that's a whole other difficult conversation to get into details, the variety of them. But if we're looking at just the puffs, if the satisfaction of smoking is that oral fixation, that motion of bringing up a smoke and inhaling that product, whatever's in that smoke, put that aside. Just the number of puffs. For a pack of smokes, that's 150 of those puffs. For one of these pods, on average, I find that, say, a Juul pod, which is, again, very similar to one of these, they sell them by a four-pack, very locally, for $24. circling around my point that a cigarette per puff, on average, is about 11 cents per puff. Per puff of one of these guys is 2 cents locally. And that's at the convenience store where it's more expensive. If you go online and you buy these, that works out to less than one half of a cent per puff. So when you're going to hear the argument that this tax is too much, it's too high, I'm trying to build the case that that is not true. I bought this little bottle right here for a dollar. A 25% would make it $1.25. So you could even say that that's not even remotely high enough. Finally, Mr. Chairman, as I move to wrap this up, this is a picture, and you've seen it before because I like to use it, and that is the 1994 the Waxman hearings. After 50 years, the leading CEOs in this country stood up under oath on record before Congress and avowed that nicotine and tobacco products were neither addictive nor harming to their consumers. And I think we all know where that went. And so once again, we're hearing from the industry, from tobacco, from e-cigarette manufacturers, that these products are safe, they're not harmful, they're not addictive, they're not toxic, and that we need more time and more data to conclude whether or not that's true. And so I guess because we don't have that data, we don't know what's in these products. They're not tested. They might claim they don't have nicotine, but they often do when they are tested. This is the time to take some action to help protect our kids. Now, in closing, I believe that there's a general agreement that the e-cigarettes can or offer a pathway to quitting smoking, traditional cigarettes. But the nature of these products, they might be safer, less toxic than cigarettes. But that shouldn't be translated that we're assuming that inhaling these substances, whatever they might be, they're not outright safe, nor are they not toxic. That's what you're going to hear. E-cigarettes don't end addiction. They just simply replace the delivery system for that addiction. You're going to hear that this is a wonderful device to help them quit smoking, that military members, age 18, willing to take a bullet, should be able to buy a cigarette, when in fact our military, they don't support this. I would ask Senator Dunbar to confirm that, but our standing military policy is that these aren't accepted on base. We need a healthy military that can run up hills and go into battle without losing their breath, that the tax rate's too high. I think I've made that point. Let's keep our eye on the ball and protect our youth from addiction. And finally, I guess before we move to invited, that's why I've been stumbling a little bit. I'll share with you that today is my father's birthday, March 24th. He passed away at the age of 64. A few years ago, and the victim of a lifetime of tobacco addiction and lung cancer. So, you know, I would call on him as my star witness today, whom I wish I could call upon to speak in favor of this bill, because trying to protect my own son, his grandson, who is a sophomore, a star student, sophomore in our high school system, and a prime target of these products, so, from becoming a statistic. So with that, I'm going to conclude and wrap up. Be happy to answer your questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Lampkin from members of the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, I have to leave soon to go to a presentation on judiciary, and I would hold my questions until after invited testimony, but I'd like to do them now if it's okay. I was reading through these provisions and trying to understand. There's one point that I kind of want to talk to you about. When we passed this in Anchorage, the issue of employment came up. And that, to me, is my primary. We did pass this, and I support the general thrust of it. But there were 19 and 20-year-olds who worked in certain establishments that were going to be put out of work, essentially, by this, by the version we had at the Anchorage Assembly. And I was trying to understand what the provisions here, how they work. And there was Section 6 and Section 7. So if you have a 19-year-old working at a gas station, for example, that happens to sell cigarettes, would they lose their job because of this? And if they worked at now at a tobacconist or whatever you call it, there's I think there's one remaining in Anchorage, but would they lose their job if we pass this?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, if you refer to page 22, section 27, lines 19 to 22, that grandfathering has been specifically included in this bill as a result of compromise from last year's session.
Okay. So grandfathering. So if they currently have a position, they can keep it. But after this bill passes, 19 and 20-year-olds will no longer be able to work at those establishments?
Through the chair, Senator Dummer, to clarify, the effective date of this bill at that time, if they are 19 or 20, they would be able to continue doing so, their employment.
Okay. And is that only for the, you know, tobacco shops, or is that all in all places that might, like a gas station that might happen to sell these products, but it's not the primary product?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. So I kind of get the thrust of what you're saying. Yes. However, technically, my understanding, and I'm sure there's Mr. Darnell is going to be able to confirm this, but very typically, when we have a vendor business operator that's a convenience store or liquor store, that type of thing, that where these products are sold in conjunction, especially with alcohol sales, there's going to be a manager or a supervisor that steps in to help execute that transaction.
Okay. I'll speak more with you offline about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Lampkin? Thank you. We will move on to invited testifiers. First up, Karen Bloxham, assistant principal with Silla High School. Ms. Bloxham, are you with us today?
Hi.
Hello, ma'am. State your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Karen Bloxham. I'm the assistant principal of Wasilla High School. Each year, the number of students caught vaping or in possession of a vape is on the rise. Students are starting to vape in the middle school and are addicted to vapes by the time they are freshmen in high school. This year, I have had sophomores disciplined for vaping for the third time in their high school career. According to the Wasilla PD, they have given out 31 citations for students caught vaping. In the Matsu School District, if you are caught vaping a second time, you are given a $500 citation from the Wasilla PD. I have freshmen telling me that they are addicted to nicotine. Many of these students are smoking much more nicotine on the vapes because of the flavor that they have compared to that of a normal cigarette. They do not realize that sometimes they are inhaling more nicotine on a vape in a day than if they picked up a pack of cigarettes and smoked. Most students tell me, and I will say 95% of students tell me, that they would never smoke cigarettes, but they will use a vape or an e-cigarette without citation.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Bloxham? Seeing none, we will move to Katie Steffens. Ms. Steffens, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Steffens, and I'm the Deputy Program Manager for the State of Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program within the Division of Public Health. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on how tobacco and nicotine products are affecting Alaskan youth and to provide consultation on strategies that are proven to prevent youth from starting these products and reducing their current use. Tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in Alaska, with smoking linked to about 600 deaths in our state each year. Alaska loses an estimated $400 million per year because of smoking-related illness effects on workers and being unable to do their usual activities. The progress we've made in reducing tobacco use is threatened due to the ongoing epidemic of e-cigarette use by youth. As of the 2019 Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey showed that one out of four high school students in Alaska were currently using e-cigarettes and almost half had ever tried them. By contrast, only one in 20 Alaska adults use these products. While we don't have a more current estimate for Alaska, a separate survey called the National Youth Tobacco Survey indicated that in 2022, 2.5 million youth nationwide are currently using e-cigarettes. Because the methods were changed, these results cannot be compared to those from earlier years, but provide a helpful snapshot that this continues to be a public health issue for youth. While we wait for our current estimates from the 2023 Alaska YRBS, we are able to offer data on how often students are being suspended due to their tobacco use or possession, including e-cigarettes, on school campuses in Alaska. During the 2021-22 school year, there were 964 tobacco-related suspensions between all grades 1 through 12. This accounted for 2,300 missed school days. The number of suspensions has increased 232% since the 2015-16 school year, when e-cigarettes were first added to the Department of Education and Early Development criteria. Alaska's youth are still accessing and using these products at high rates. Fortunately, we know what worked to bring down youth cigarette use and can apply these same comprehensive strategies to e-cigarettes and nicotine products. We know that increasing the price of tobacco products is the single most effective way to prevent initiation and to reduce consumption. Youth and young adults are 2 to 3 times more likely to respond to price increases of tobacco products. Price increases are even more effective when implemented in combination with other proven strategies, such as increasing the minimum legal age. It's estimated that raising the minimum age for the sale of tobacco products to 21 will over time reduce the smoking rate by about 12% and smoking-related deaths by 10%. Senate Bill 89 includes both of these proven approaches, increasing the minimum age and increasing the price. It creates additional protections for youth through restricting online sales, implementing age verification processes when shipping or transporting tobacco products in Alaska, as there were exceptions for Alaska in the Federal PACT Act, and limiting the nicotine content in these devices. In closing, I'd like to stress how taking action now to curb the e-cigarette epidemic among youth will contribute to healthier outcomes for Alaskans. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'll be remaining on the line available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Steffens. Are there questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we will move to Joe Darnell. Mr. Darnell, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Joe Darnell, and I'm the Chief Investigator for Underage Tobacco Enforcement for the Department of Behavioral Health. I always get a kick out of being the third or fourth one speaking because Mr. Lampkin does such a good job and Ms. Steffens does such a good job on explaining everything. I don't have that much to add other than what I'm seeing in the field when we're actually out here working. One of the things with the 21, we've heard that it needs to, the state needs to come online with 19 to 21 for the reasons that were already said, but also to make it fair for the retailers. I mean, retailers are out there. Some are opting not to enforce the Central 21 law, so they're only enforcing the state law at 19, which makes it an level playing field for all the retailers across. It also makes it easier for all these retailers that do sell age-restricted products, when you're talking alcohol, marijuana, or tobacco products, because state driver's licenses and state IDs are set up that if you're 21 or older, it's a horizontal layout. If you're under 21, it's a vertical layout. So the retailer automatically knows when they ask for an ID, and it's handed to them, that if it's a vertical layout on the ID, they need to take look closer to it, because they could be 21 and still haven't swapped it over, but it gives them a heads up to really, really look at the ID. We're traveling around the state. We work with different coalitions and schools around the state, and they're all saying the same thing, like Ms. Steffens said, the increase in suspensions in the schools. I got a call recently from Dillingham saying there's an increase of vape products and stuff there and how we can help them with them. We're working with them now. I had some of my guys down in on Prince of Wales Island last week, and they ended up, ran and was talking to one of the troopers there, and the trooper was saying that the schools there on Prince of Wales Island are being inundated with vape products and not knowing what to do with them. So it's important that we get all of our stakeholders together. I mean, when we're talking about the state, the legislature, our national partners, the school, the coalitions, the retailers, all have a stake in this, and it just comes back down to how we can all get together and work as a group to protect our youth. I'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Darnell. Are there questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we will go next to Brandon Spanos. Mr. Spanos, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, this is Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division, and I was going to go over our fiscal note. Is this the time to do that?
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. So the fiscal note would generate from the tax $3.2 million in fiscal year 24, and then going forward, $3.3 million in 2025. We did anticipate growth of the market and the effect of the elasticity of the tax on the reducing marijuana consumption, or excuse me, this isn't a marijuana hearing, it's an e-cigarette hearing, e-cigarette consumption. We were asked not to include, not by the bill sponsor, but by others, not to include the cost of increased costs over time. So inflation has not been taken into account, but the market was taken into account. The cost to implement the tax are somewhat high, only because we don't have a tax like this currently. There was a bill that's already been discussed that passed last year and then was vetoed, and that was a less cost. And the reason for that was that it was an other tobacco product tax, or rather the current definition of other tobacco was being broadened to include vapor products. And therefore, we could use our current software and our current resources to implement, to administer that tax. Under this current structure of the bill, we would have to set up a new sales tax, and that would have an initial cost to it and some additional personnel. And that's the reason for the $222,000 in fiscal year 24 and the $198,000 going forward to administer that tax.
Very good. Thank you very much for that explanation. Could you talk a little bit about on the seller side, how easy it should be for retailers to use a point of sale system to implement this tax at the retail point?
Sure. Most sellers, retailers will already have a point of sale software, and the software will include a tax line in it. So I'm sure many of you have gone to a store and purchased something in a muni that doesn't have a tax, and it'll show a tax line and it'll have zero on it. That's because often it's just easier to not pay someone to delete that line in your software. You just zero it out. So many of those would just have to go in and put a rate in to apply to certain products, and the software would be able to administer the tax. Then for the retailer themselves, they would then need to collect that tax and then our online system is quite robust. We are upgrading it right now. It'll be upgraded by January of 2024 so that taxpayers will actually be able to file tax returns online for any of the taxes that we currently have. And of course, that would include any new taxes like this as well.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none. Due to time constraints today, we will not be taking public testimony. However, during our next meeting, we will do a deep dive into the sectional analysis and take public testimony at that time. As a reminder, if members of the public have written testimony on this or any bill, it can be submitted to the committee at slac@akleg.gov. That is slac@akleg.gov. At this time, we will set this bill aside and take up the next item on our agenda. Brief at ease. Back on the record, it's 2:10 back in Belch Room 105 at Thomas Stewart Building in the beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Up next, Senate Bill 51, Controlled Substance Database Exempting Veterinarians. Here to present the bill, we have bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Lukey Gale Tobin. Senator, thank you for joining us with your staff. Please state your name and affiliations for the record and proceed with your introduction of the bill.
Thank you very much, and thank you for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Senator Lukey Gale Tobin, and I represent the communities of Fairview, South Addition, Downtown, Government Hill, Jay Bear, and parts of Northeast Muldoon, East Ridge, and North Star. Today, I am presenting here on Senate Bill 51, and Senate Bill 51 is in response to the nationwide opioid epidemic. The Alaska State Legislature established the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, joining several other states in this very proactive approach to trying to keep a database and fight against drug misuse through a controlled substance database. However, there are major differences between the practice of human medicine and veterinary medicine. SB 51 addresses those conflicts by exempting veterinarians from the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Humans are not like our beloved four-legged friends, and a one-size-fits-all approach is not appropriate in this context. Eliminating the requirement for veterinarians in Alaska to use the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, also known as the PDMP, does not mean veterinarians will go unregulated. Veterinarians will continue to be covered by federal statutes and regulated by the Drug Enforcement Agency, also known as the DEA, and the Alaska Board of Veterinarian Examiners. Additionally, provisions in state statutes will continue to limit the number of opioids a veterinarian can prescribe in a 7-day prescription with 2 exemptions. Prescription drug monitoring is not unique to Alaska. All 50 states have some variation of this program, with over 30 states exempting veterinarians. Previously, 10 of those states mandated veterinarians to be part of their prescription drug monitoring, but later went and exempted them. In Alaska, the PDMP fails to be effective because our animal friends do not have identifiers like social security numbers. As a result, veterinarians must try to get the private health data from folks like you and I so that their animals who are seeking treatment will actually be able to receive it. So in the case of my family, that means depending on which human brings our beloved pet to the veterinarian, it could be my invasion of privacy, it could be my spouse's privacy that's invaded, or it could be our pet healthcare provider whose privacy is invaded. Veterinary facilities are not subject to HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. They don't have the same security rules. Senate Bill 51 seeks to correct an overexpansion of the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program to ensure continued access to quality veterinarian care in Alaska. So with that, I'm going to encourage you all to look at the supporting documents that are in your packet and also available on BASIS. I'm going to pass it over to my friend here, Trevor Bailey, to provide the sectional analysis. And I ask the committee to hold your questions, as I admittedly am not an expert in the PDMP, but we do have someone here to provide invited testimony who is.
For the record, this is Trevor Bailey, staff to Senator Tobin, and I'm going to go over the sectional. So Section 1 deletes the requirement that the Board of Veterinary Examiners notify the Board of Pharmacy when a practitioner registers with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Section 2 creates a new subsection in the Controlled Substance Prescription Database statutes that exempts veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. Section 3 repeals the subsection that requires veterinarians register with the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. And Section 4 states that the Act takes effect immediately upon passage. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I have one note to add to this. There has been previous iterations of this bill in previous legislatures. Some members of this committee may recognize that from the 32nd legislature. Although this legislation looks very different from one in previous legislatures, it still has the same legislative intent and purpose. Our legislative legal department decided to draft the bill in what they described as a more clean and succinct way.
Thank you.
With that, if it's all right for the committee, again, Luki Tobin, Senator for District I, for the record, we'd like to pass it on to our invited testifier who will be going through a PowerPoint presentation for the committee.
That would be most excellent. Thank you, Madam Senator. The sponsor has invited Dr. Rachel Berngard, Chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners, to make a presentation to our committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rachel, last name is Berngard, and I'm the current Chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners. I'm also a licensed veterinarian, and I've been a licensed veterinarian in the state of Alaska since 2002. Normally, for this presentation, I would have my colleague, Dr. Tracy Ward, speaking on behalf of the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association, who has been kind enough to provide the PowerPoint. Dr. Ward is unable to make it today, so I will be doing her slides as well. And then I do believe we also have Drs. Dick and Dr. Delker on the line to answer any questions that may be specific to the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association. So Senate Bill 51 is an act exempting the veterinarians from the requirements of the Controlled Substance Prescription Database. The Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association supports SV 51, which is the professional organization, and then the organization that I'm here on behalf of, the Alaska Board of Veterinary Examiners, also supports Senate Bill 51. Furthermore, last year, the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, which is the board that administers the prescription drug monitoring program, supported exempting veterinarians from participating in the PDMP through a motion, as well as, and while we don't have it in this packet, we do have a companion bill on the House side. The Alaska State Medical Association has expressed their non-opposition to exempting veterinarians from the prescription drug monitoring program. So for a little bit of background, and I won't go into too much detail since Senator Tobin did a wonderful job, in 2008, the Alaska PDMP was established. Participation was voluntary at that time. In 2017, in reaction to an increasing opioid epidemic, the PDMP, through amendment HV 159 was included to require all DEA permit holders, which included veterinarians, to utilize the system, and it was a mandatory utilization. Neither the Alaska State Veterinary Medical Association nor the Board of Veterinary Examiners were consulted regarding this amendment. And just so that you understand what the statute does, is it requires reporting for all actively licensed practitioners who hold a DEA license. So not all vets hold a DEA license, but if you hold a DEA license, and if you prescribe, administer, or dispense federally scheduled 2, 3, or 4 controlled substances in the state, you must utilize the prescription drug monitoring program. So what does that mean? The prescription drug monitoring program is not an effective database for veterinarians or our patients. And to keep in mind, our patients are the animal patients. They're not the human clients. The PDMP was established for human medicine. And as Senator Tobin spoke to, animals don't have unique identifiers, like a social security number. They might not even have a birth date that we're aware of. Their names might change throughout their lifetime. Their owners, as Senator Tobin described, you know, might be a husband one day, it might be the pet sitter the next day. Who's presenting the animal to the veterinarian for care may change. So what do veterinarians have to do? Veterinarians are currently required to query the human private health information, controlled substance information, that is, specifically, if the veterinarian is contemplating prescribing or dispensing a controlled substance to the animal. The human data that's obtained from the prescription drug monitoring program, when us veterinarians have to look at that information, we don't know what that information means as far as, is that an appropriate amount for this human being to be on? Is it an inappropriate amount? What sort of a conversation, if any, should we be having, which we would say we should not be having a conversation with the humans about their private health information. We don't understand if it's an appropriate dose, length of time, number of refills, all of those sorts of things. And as veterinarians, we understand that drug dosages can vary tremendously between species. So we can't extrapolate and say, well, hey, this looks about like the right amount for a dog, so it's probably okay for this human, or vice versa. And same thing with human trained doctors and pharmacists. They're not trained in animal prescriptions. So any data that we could possibly input to this program would not necessarily be usable for the human healthcare provider. So querying of human information is an invasion into the client's medical privacy. Vets aren't covered by HIPAA, and yes, we're not covered by HIPAA, which means we're also not we're not obligated to follow the HIPAA requirements. But what does that really mean? It means our screens in our offices, we don't have the screen protectors that you would find in human healthcare medicine. We don't have that confidential relationship with necessarily the client. We have patient-client confidentiality, but it gets pretty murky when we start thinking about having humans' healthcare information and how that relates to confidentiality with regards to our duties to our patient and the client. So you'll see on this slide, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but examples of some common medications. We all think about this prescription drug monitoring program as being something that deals explicitly with opiates. It's not. It deals with controlled substances. So there are a lot of different controlled substances that we as veterinarians may be able to see. And I think it's a good point to ask yourself that if someone that you did not enjoy a doctor-patient privilege with were to have access to this type of private information, how would that make you feel? And it's a concern for us veterinarians, and it's a big concern for our clients. So also, as Senator Tobin spoke about, veterinarians are monitored by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and we must adhere to strict record keeping and storage requirements for all controlled substances, whether they're opiates or not. Those records must be made available to DEA or other law enforcement upon request. Anytime we administer or dispense even a tenth of a milliliter of a controlled substance, that gets logged as far as the date, the patient, the client, how that was administered. That is all logged and kept in those records. The other kind of oversight program that veterinarians participate in is that all of our distributors, so the people that we buy our veterinary prescription medications through, they participate in the suspicious order monitoring system. So what that means is when you register your clinic, you have to say, hey, I am a small animal practice. I do X number of surgeries per day. I employ how many doctors? And so those companies start to be able to put together a profile as far as what's a normal ordering amount for a clinic such as yours. Anything that falls outside of that normal amount, any sudden changes, those sorts of things, those are reported to the DEA. So this is not veterinarians, even with exempting us from the prescription drug monitoring program, veterinarians are still very heavily regulated. We're not asking Alaska to be a guinea pig. Pardon the expression there. 33 other states have already exempted veterinarians from participating in the prescription drug monitoring program. 10 of those states formerly did require vets to do so, but due to the same problems that we're seeing here with the prescription drug monitoring program and veterinary inclusion, they repealed the veterinary inclusion. So another major point to consider is that veterinarians are not a source of the drugs that are of primary concern. The graph here in front of us shows trends in U.S. drug overdose deaths. And I apologize, there's a misprint on this screen here. Synthetic opioids, excluding methadone, overdose deaths have increased 97-fold at this point. Those synthetic opioids that we're talking about are related to oxycodone and fentanyl. Those are drugs that veterinarians simply do not dispense. We don't use oxycodone at all in veterinary medicine. And if fentanyl is to be used, it's used in very specific situations and administered in the hospital to, let's say, a surgical patient. It's not something that would ever be sent home with an animal. It further makes sense to exempt veterinarians from the prescription drug monitoring program because I can tell you, as the chair of the Board of Veterinary Examiners, we've seen our investigative costs increase since 2018 when veterinarians were mandated to participate in this program. And the cost increase is due to investigations into veterinarians for not being able to use an unusable system. To be clear, there has been no identification of nefarious behavior by veterinarians from these investigations since 2018. Currently at our last board meeting, which was just held at the end of February, we checked in with investigations, and there are currently no open investigations with veterinarians as related to the prescription drug monitoring program. Just as I was talking about fees increasing with regards to investigation expenses, the veterinary board, we're a self-supporting board, generally speaking. So what that means is that our veterinarian license fees, our technician license fees, go to support board activities, board investigations. We already have the highest licensing fees for veterinarians in the country. The country is experiencing a veterinary shortage, and Alaska is also experiencing a veterinary shortage. We want to do what we can to make Alaska look attractive to recruit and retain new veterinarians, and having the highest licensing fees in the country is not necessarily going to help to do that. So in conclusion, the Alaska Veterinary Medical Association and the Board of Veterinary Examiners ask for support of Senate Bill 51. It will allow veterinarians to provide appropriate, timely medical management appropriate for each of their animal patients. It will increase the efficiency of the prescription drug monitoring program for its intended purpose by allowing for accurate interpretation of human data. Veterinarians will continue to judiciously use controlled substances, and it will eliminate unnecessary and disproportionate business burdens for veterinarians. Thank you very much for your time and for hearing this bill today, and I'm available for any questions you may have.
Are there questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Berngardt.
Thank you, Chair.
Members have a draft proposed CS in their packets. Senator Bishop, may I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS Senate Bill 51, work order number 33-Lima Sierra 0039/Bravo as the working document.
Very good. I will object for an explanation. At ease. We're back on the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to restate the motion.
Please do.
I move CS for Senate Bill 51, work order number 33-Lima Sierra 0339/Bravo as the working document.
I'll object for a purpose of explanation. My staff will Laura Ashe will walk us through the changes made by the CS.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Ashe. I am staff to Senator Bjorkman. In addition to the issue contained in Senate Bill 51, the Alaska Board of Veterinary Examiners has a second concern that requires a legislative solution. And that is that there are, in the state of Alaska, veterinarians who are eminently qualified in their knowledge and skill set, but are not able to be licensed under the requirements in statute. And so the board has asked that the statutes be expanded to include additional means by which qualified veterinarians can be certified. Like many of the other industries in Alaska that have come before this committee, veterinary medicine is another area where there's shortages. And so being able to put these veterinarians to work in Alaska and perhaps even attract more veterinarians to Alaska is very important. Mr. Chairman, I do have Dr. Sierra Valaro from the board online to explain the background for why this request was made. I'm also happy to walk through the sections of the CS if you'd like.
Very good. Let's take a look at the sections of the CS, and then we will go to Dr. Valaro.
Certainly. Section 1 of Version B would amend Alaska Statute 0898.050B to add that the Board of Veterinary Examiners may adopt a certification process for veterinarians to become licensed to practice in Alaska. Section 2 would amend AS 08.98.165A to allow the board to accept certification through the program for the assessment of veterinary education equivalents in place of attending an accredited program in the United States. The language in this section would also allow the boards the discretion to approve other certification processes. And Section 3 contains the same changes. It would amend AS 08.98.184, Section 1, to allow the board to accept certification through the program for assessment of veterinary education equivalents in place of attending an accredited program in the United States, and would allow the board the discretion to approve other certification processes. And then the rest of the sections proceed forth as they did in the original version of SB 51.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions for Laura about the CS? Seeing none, we will call upon Dr. Sierra Valaro for some commentary regarding this change. Ms. Valaro, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman and the committee, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sierra Valaro, and I serve as a member on the Board of Veterinary Examiners. As discussed from Laura, thank you very much. In order to improve the quality and availability of veterinary services in the state of Alaska, the board's requesting statutory changes to licensing requirements for foreign veterinary graduates. Currently, the Alaska statutes mandate educational commission for foreign veterinary graduate certification. This program is the original program developed in 1971 by the American Veterinary Medical Association to ensure competency equivalent to graduates of American and Canadian veterinary schools. The American Association of Veterinary State Boards created a similar certification program entitled PAVE, Program for the Assessment of Veterinary Education Equivalents, in 2001. The American Association of Veterinary State Boards supervises the veterinary state boards of all states and is an organization that Alaska actually utilizes in the veterinary licensing process. This newer program is recognized by 46 U.S. states and territories, all Canadian provinces and territories, Australia, and New Zealand. The two programs, the Educational Commission for Foreign Veterinary Graduate Certification and PAVE, are very similar in their requirements and require years to complete the many phases to prove competency. Furthermore, like any student from an American accredited veterinary school, candidates still have to pass the National American Veterinary Licensing Exam, which is mandatory for licensing veterinary licensure in the entire United States. Most state veterinary legislations only specify the Educational Commission for Veterinary graduate certification in their statutes and regulations initially, resulting in having to go through the legislative updates to add PAVE. When making this change, states have adopted different strategies and wording. The Board of Veterinary Examiners are requesting the amendment to these statutes to include PAVE or another certification approved by the board to prevent the need to revise statutes again in the future in another certification program if another certification program is created. This wording requested mimics 23 other states. In conclusion, the outdated statute unnecessarily creates a barrier to Alaska increasing availability of veterinarians to provide care to the public. To date, we know of at least two veterinary internal medicine specialists who were licensed in other U.S. states that did not apply for an Alaskan license because they graduated from a foreign veterinary college and had received certification from PAVE. With that being said, it's unknown exactly how many veterinarians Alaska has missed out on licensing because our state requirements are outdated by not including the PAVE. And I would have any question if I'm available for any questions if needed.
Thank you, Dr. DeFilaro. Are there any questions from members of the committee for Dr. DeFilaro? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to the CS? Seeing and hearing none, the CS version /B is before us as the working document. We will not be taking public testimony today on this bill. During the next meeting on the bill, we will take public testimony. As a reminder, if members of the public have written testimony on this or any bill, it can be submitted to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at slac@akleg.gov. Once again, that email address is slac@akleg.gov. At this time, we will set this bill aside and take up the next item on our agenda. Briefies. We're back on the record, 236 here in Belch Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Next up is Senate Bill 93, Fisherman's Fund Vessel Owner Claims. A first order of business on Senate Bill 93 is the draft proposed CS in members' packets. Senator Bishop, may I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I move CS for Senate Bill 93, Work Order Number 33, Lima Sierra 538 /Bravo is a working document.
Very good. I'll ask my staff once again, Ms. Laura Ashe, to walk us through the bill, including changes made by the CS.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, I am Laura Ashe, staff to Senator Bjorkman, and I'd like to introduce on the committee's behalf Senate Bill 93, an act relating to claims against protection and indemnity insurance policies of vessel owners and providing for an effective date. The Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council has requested that the maximum reimbursement that a vessel owner can receive when filing a claim for the injury or illness of a crew member be raised from the current value of $5,000. The council proposed raising it to $10,000, which matches the deductible on many of the policies owned by vessel owners. There was conversation in the House Fisheries Committee on HB 92, sponsored by the Fisheries Committee, a companion to this legislation. In that committee, the bill was amended to increase the maximum claim amount to $15,000. The discussion in the House Fisheries Committee was that some fishermen have said to committee members that $10,000 isn't always enough to cover costs that are not covered by insurance or that are part of the deductible. In addition, if members look in your packets, you will see that there are projections of the fund which show that even with the $15,000 maximum, the projected
disbursements from the fund leave the balance still very stable. And so it becomes a philosophical question in a situation in which a fund is created to serve a population. It's finding that balance between keeping the fund itself healthy, but not allowing disbursements from the fund to serve the balance of the fund more than they serve the population that the fund was intended to serve. And so for that reason, the House Fisheries Committee adopted that change. And so the senator put that before the committee today for your consideration. I am happy to walk through the bill. It's very simple. It has two sections. The first changes the maximum amount from $5,000 to, in the CS, $15,000. And then Section 2 provides for an immediate effective date. Mr. Chairman, with that, Charles Collins, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and Bellman Thomas, the Program Coordinator, are here, and they can provide more information on the Council's reasoning for the requested change and answer any questions that committee members may have.
Thank you, Laura. Before we bring up folks from the Department of Labor, are there questions for Ms. Ashe? Okay. Seeing none, I will remove my objection to this CS. Is there any further objection to the CS? Seeing and hearing none, the CS version /B is before the committee as a working document. At this time, we will move on to invited testimony from Mr. Chuck Collins, Director of the Division of Workers' Comp, and Velma Thomas, Program Coordinator for Workers' Compensation Guarantee Fund. Oh, Fisherman's Fund.
I wear a lot of different hats.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. Collins and Ms. Thomas. Please state your names and affiliations for the record and begin your presentation.
Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, which also includes the Fisherman's Fund. And we're here today to answer any questions for you. We have been tasked by the Fisherman's Fund Council at bringing their wishes before this. The division has taken a long, hard look to make sure that the Fisherman's Fund, which was established in 1951 before Alaska was a state, and has served fishermen, commercial fishermen, ever since. And we take the business of protecting that fund and making sure that it's available for those that are in need of its use will be there forever. And with that, I'll turn it over to Velma, who is my program coordinator on this and has serves as somewhat the actuary on the fund.
So. For the record, Velma Thomas, and I'm the program coordinator for Workers' Compensation Division, and I'm also the fund administrator for three funds in the agency, which Fisherman's Fund is one of them. And so I can just bring a short history of the information that I've seen come across the years. And it's really to focus on the bullet points, you know, high points. I don't think there's any low points, but overall, I've been with the agency since 2012. The vessel owner reimbursement portion did experience a change in 2010. When I started, the benefit cap was $2,500. And then it was introduced to, it was a portion, it was either 50% or whatever was less that a vessel owner could apply and get reimbursed. So from there, we haven't seen that it affected the fund in a negative way. And so now the council feels that it is appropriate to go ahead and proceed and ask for an increase. The original increase from the resolution was $10,000. And then there was an amendment submitted under HB 92 to consider $15,000 for the vessel owner reimbursement and also $15,000 for the injured fisherman. So at this point, the worst case scenario that was used, I went back 9 years, and in those 9 years, it included the highest paid benefits and also included the lowest amount of revenue that came in. And so, and that's how we kind of averaged it out of possibly, you know, in that time period, the 9 years, it averaged out to 9 claims, and we were paying out about $20,000. I guess we were $21,000 per claim. And it wasn't a significant amount that would affect the fund at this time. I don't know if a history of the fund or the revenue stream, I'll just go over that. 39% of the money that comes from commercial fishermen's permits and the crew member licenses up to $50 is what goes into the fund. So pretty much it is self-funded. We do, as our role here in the agency, we're here to support the council members. They meet twice a year. They review all claims that are over the fund limit, which is $10,000, and any claims that require or request additional benefits beyond that. And so the council also looks at all the claims that we've denied. So we feel that the council is very active. The members have been on there for a long time, and they're very passionate, and they care about the fund and how it's grown, and also the management of the fund. And so that's probably about all I can provide right now, but I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas, did you model this, or did RNA model this research?
I did. Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I proceeded to start, and then it was done through the division.
Okay. A follow-up?
Please.
I believe when I was there, it was at $11 million, so I'm comfortable with these numbers. That when I look at the worst-case scenario, I start to get a little nervous. The only thing I would ask Mr. Collins is, if this starts trending the right way, you'd be the first one up here to make a change.
Through the chair, Senator, as I stated before, and as you well know, we take it extremely serious. So we've already made the promise on the House side that if we felt like their upper limit was going to impact the fund, that you would know right away. As Ms. Thomas has stated, the council is extremely watchful of that fund. And since it's older than I am, you know, we want to make sure it stays for another 100 years or something. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from members of the committee? I have a couple of questions. First is about eligibility. What do crew members, deckhands, and vessel owners have to do in order to be eligible to receive money from the Fisherman's Fund?
It's a great question, Chairman. There are about 5 criteria. The primary criteria is that the injury must have occurred in Alaska, and then they must have had. Yes, I was kidding. And they have to have a valid crew member license or permit. And then everything else is pretty much got here. It has to be related to commercial fishing, not necessarily they were out fishing, but if they were preparing the boat for the season, that type of thing. They must seek treatment within 120 days. And that actually, I think, since the beginning of the fund, that was recently changed in 2019. It used to be 60 days. So we saw the trend that it was really difficult for the injured fishermen to come in. And, you know, if you're having a good season, we've seen people with broken arms and, you know, gashes in their leg. They're going to keep fishing. So it was really difficult for them to, you know, that 60 days, it is a long time to be in pain, I guess, in injury. But I'm not a fisherman. It's a hardy crew. So they're willing to finish the season. So from that feedback, we changed that. So they now have 120 days to seek treatment. This is the first treatment for the injury. And then they have a year to file a claim. And even then, if they can't meet filing the claim, they still can present the claim overall for the council to review and possibly find just cause to give them benefits. So we really go out of our way to help folks through the process. Same with the vessel owners. The information that I presented here is actually based on vessel owner claims that were filed. And so once they're filed, that doesn't mean someone's still going to go through the process to give us the paperwork to actually get approved for the benefits to be paid out. So I think it was very, very conservative, probably for the first 3 years, I would estimate. But we would keep our eye on it if suddenly the trend moved up and we're getting thousands of claims. But claims have been down, and so I think it makes sense. I think it's a good support for the commercial fishing industry.
Very good.
I hope I answered your question.
So you did.
Since the fund is a payer of last resort, that means that in this case, the vessel owners would have had to have filed. They had to both have a P&I insurance protection and indemnity, and then they would actually have to file that, and then we would be reimbursing that portion that the insurance company was, or a portion of the portion that the insurance company was not covering. So that it truly is an Alaskan thing, because number one, they take care of themselves, and number two, it's not set up so that anybody makes a windfall from it. It's just a recovery of what they do spend. So,
thank you very much, Mr. Collins. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a workers' compensation if a fisherman is hurt on the job. So what happens if a vessel with fishermen is lost at sea? What happens with that situation?
Well, through the chair, Senator, number one, we have to take workers' compensation completely out of it, because fishermen are not covered by workers' compensation under the Jones Act. As the Fisherman's Fund is the payer of last resort, heaven forbid that someone, that we would lose anyone at sea, whether it's a vessel full or even one fisherman. But secondly, we would pray that they carried insurance on that, because that is truly the only way that they are going to be able to be made what we deem as whole in this industry, where money makes up for loss of certain things. And then the fund would merely be paying the, you know, maybe the deductible or some other costs that insurance just did not cover. So
I appreciate that. If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
And the only reason why I ask is because I had a friend who was on a vessel lost at sea. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Are there other questions from members of the committee? I have one more. I just wanted to clarify. So insurance is required in order for a fisherman to receive money from the fund. Is that correct?
Chair Bjorkman, that is correct. The fund is not set up as the insurance for the industry. The fund is there to backstop what they do for insurance. And the impetus for the ask for this is that the deductibles and the cost of insurance, let's start with the cost of insurance, has continually risen, as with many industries, and thus a number of our employers, vessel owners, vessel operators, have went to higher deductible to save costs. As you well know, a lot of these vessels work on a shared wage reward, and so they're trying to be very careful with their costs, yet it is still a very dangerous occupation. And so while they might carry the insurance, it might have a fairly high deductible, and we are merely trying to help the industry self-regulate and stay healthy.
So. Very good. Thank you. At this time, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 93. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Please come forward. State your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill today. My name is Tracy Welch. I am the Executive Director for United Fishermen of Alaska. I'm here today to lend our support to Senate Bill 93 and the increase to deductible reimbursement for vessel owners. As you've heard from staff, the fund is very healthy. It's paid for by fishermen and for fishermen. And this is a great chance for us to be able to help those fishermen who are seeing a high increase in their deductibles. You know, we were talking this afternoon and some vessel owners are seeing $10,000, $15,000 for deductibles. So this is a way to help them out and to provide a little bit of incentive for them to hold insurance on their P&I insurance for their boats and the crew. And I understand that there's a CS for the Senate Bill 93 on the table. We would support also the House version, which includes a $15,000 and $15,000 for crew injury, as well as the deductible reimbursement. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Questions for Ms. Welch?
All right.
Thank you for your testimony. Jerry McCune, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent Jerry McCune. I represent Cordova District Fishermen United. I was here when we raised it once before, but I think 15-15 is it'd be fair looking at the fund and at the graph, because you could hardly, when we raised the 10,000 for the side of the fishermen, you could barely walk in the ER room for that amount of money. So I think 15 would be really good on that side. And this side, I just got my insurance bill for my boat, so I can tell you that insurance has really, really went up, especially if you got like a crew of four seining. It's going to cost you a lot of money. So anyway, I think 15-15 would be a very good solution for the fund. And like they say, if the fund started getting into some kind of trouble, we'd be the first ones in here. And the fishermen that sit on the fund, I know them all, and they all take very good care and very serious about this fund, keeping it solvent. But I think the fishermen also need that side raised a little bit in the medical costs today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McCune, for your testimony. Questions from members of the committee? Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify to Senate Bill 93? Seeing no one else wishing to testify, I will close public testimony and bring the bill back before the committee. At this time, we will set this bill aside and take it up at a future meeting. Our next meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will be on Monday, March 27th. We will take up Senate Bill 74, 75, 84, and Senate Bill 45. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at this time, this meeting is adjourned at 2:57 p.m.